Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, maybe Microsoft's not so big and bad after all. The software company has thrown in the towel, just given up the ghost in its 10-year antitrust fight with European regulators. As of today, Microsoft's officially a monopoly. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management. Committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 22nd of October today. You know, it didn't take much to get Microsoft to knuckle under. Just close to a decade of legal fights and $1.5 billion in fines, with the possibility of billions more to come. Hordes of lawyers have spent the past 9 years hashing out the arguments in courtrooms all over the European Union. But here's the executive summary, courtesy of our New York bureau chief, Jill Barchet.
Microsoft's been in court fighting European regulators since 2004. The company was considering appealing to the highest court in the EU before it backed down. Now it's throwing open the doors to let competitors connect with its Windows operating system. Jonathan Zuck is the president of the Association for Competitive Technology. His trade group is funded by Microsoft. He says Microsoft's competitors no longer have to negotiate licensing fees each time they want to connect with Windows. Now they'll pay a flat rate of 10,000 euros.
On top of that, there's an optional patent license if they want to make their servers behave more like Microsoft servers.
Zuck says Microsoft is likely to adopt this new pricing structure worldwide. Big software companies like Oracle, Sun, and even Linux are the big winners in this case. Now it's easier for them to sell servers and products to companies that primarily use Windows. Shane Coughlin of the Free Software Foundation says Microsoft's capitulation might help open the market up. But he says Microsoft may continue to block competitors by demanding multiple patent fees.
We need to interoperate. Computers need to be able to talk with each other. It's been a real problem over the last decades that Microsoft has been very reluctant to allow interoperability. We need to solve this, otherwise everyone will be locked into single solutions from one vendor.
Microsoft also has to pay a fine, but it's not clear how much. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
The Federal Trade Commission's not commenting on a possible antitrust case back here at home. The New York Times reported this morning the FTC is leaning against looking into chipmaker Intel. Intel's biggest rival, Advanced Micro Devices, has been complaining for years that Intel regularly abuses its market dominance. Brazilian President Lula da Silva said today he's hopeful the latest round of global trade talks can still be saved. There's been some concern what's known as the Doha round might be DOA come the end of the year. Lula's vote counts because Brazil's been leading a group of developing countries pressing the U.S. and Europe to change their trade policies, agriculture specifically. And there is some news today which leads one to believe Brazil might be taken even more seriously now. It used to be one of the world's most indebted countries. But thanks to surging commodity prices and better fiscal management, Brazil is now sitting on a pile of cash, and it's looking for places to spend it. From the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
To get a feel for how extraordinary Brazil's turnaround has been, let's rewind to 2002. Voters there elected a leftist union leader as president, and the international markets freaked out. Investors yanked $60 billion out of Brazil, a flight of unprecedented proportions. Now, 5 years later, Brazil's paid off its international debt, its budget is balanced, and investors are back. Analyst Chris Garmans with the Eurasia Group.
Brazil's government pursued responsible and orthodox monetary policy, drove inflation down, and as a result, the country's debt per GDP ratio has been declining ever since.
Brazil even has $162 billion in reserves. The country's leftist administration says it'll use that money not for social programs, but for investments with a potentially high return. Professor Reardon Roed is with Johns Hopkins University. He says Brazil's President Lula has made fixing the country's finances a matter of national pride.
He's able to explain to the poor that the reason Bolsa Família and the various social investment programs are working is because the macroeconomics are so strong. And for the first time in Brazilian history, poverty levels have begun to drop, and that's what got him elected the second time.
The international community is getting ready to reward President Lula for his fiscal discipline. After years languishing at junk status, Brazil's credit rating is expected to be lifted next year to investment grade. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Speaking of credit ratings, yeah, we know it's only Monday, but this is shaping up to be a big week for government bond deals. California is scheduled to sell $7 billion of its debt to investors. It's the biggest offering of its kind since the state's fiscal crisis 4 years ago. Ohio plans to offer more than $5 billion in tobacco bonds. Those notes are going to be funded by Ohio's share of that big tobacco settlement a couple of years back. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains now why we may be seeing more deals like these in the near future.
California sells bonds almost every year to bridge short-term gaps in its budget. But this year, the state is borrowing almost five times as much as it did last year. Matt Fabian of Municipal Market Advisors says the housing recession has eroded California's tax revenues. He predicts more states will turn to the bond market as the economy slows.
States and local governments are in desperate need of funds in general, and they tend to borrow more as their budgets get tight. And we're certainly headed into a period of more difficult financial times for the states.
Fabian expects municipal governments to sell $425 billion worth of bonds this year. That would be a new record. Ohio's bond sale is a bit different from California's. The state is one of 46 that settled with the major tobacco companies almost a decade ago. By selling bonds to investors, Ohio gets the settlement money up front. Gary Pollack invests in municipal bonds for Deutsche Bank Private Wealth Management. He says bondholders risk not getting paid as tobacco profits decline.
These bonds are lower quality bonds because the security comes from just four tobacco companies. And cigarette consumption is declining in the United States. So if you look at the cash flows, they are not improving. They're just getting worse.
Tobacco bonds issued by other states have done well. They gained more than 7% last year, according to Merrill Lynch. If Ohio manages to sell all its bonds, analysts say it would be the largest tobacco deal yet. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was a big investment in a big Wall Street investment bank today. A Chinese iBank called CITIC Securities announced it's going to take a $1 billion stake in Bear Stearns. A press release said the deal will give Bear Stearns a better position in the Chinese market. But think back a couple of months with me now. It was the unwinding of a couple of Bear Stearns hedge funds that really kicked the subprime mess into high gear. And there's been speculation ever since that Bear would be looking for a partner of some kind. Otherwise, on Wall Street today, it was a wild ride. Down 100, up 50, that kind of thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Home ownership in this country is as high as it's ever been. Almost 70% of Americans own a house. If you've been reading the business pages, though, you know there's a catch. It's spelled subprimes. A lot of recent buyers are losing equity in their homes as the housing market fades. Commentator and economist Austin Goolsbee says if you're one of them, it's time to face reality.
When housing prices go down, there's always one guy on your street with an insanely high price. When you say prices are down, he's got fingers in his ear saying, la, 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 la. Turns out almost everybody refuses to sell their house for less than what they paid. The explanation you hear is that they can't afford to lose the money. Economists say they're crazy. The fact is they've already lost the money. They lost it when house prices fell. Listing your house for more money is not going to change that. One of the iron laws of economics is stuff is worth what it's worth. Nobody cares what you originally paid, so if you ask too much, you're setting yourself up for a fall, a big one. Take Boston. In the early 1990s, when condo prices fell 40%, the people who bought high set their prices much higher than people selling identical condos they bought for less. There was so much overpriced real estate that the entire market went into a deep freeze. More than 70% of the properties took longer than 6 months to sell. Now that's threatening to repeat itself all over the country. And when housing markets freeze up, it means bad, bad things for the economy. It means fewer house sales, which means fewer sales of new furniture, new stoves, new plasma TVs. Face it, who likes getting up early every day and having people traipse through your bathroom and rejecting you over and over? So look, let's make a deal. Some money is better than no money. It's better for you. It's better for everyone. You'll unload your house and buy something else and buy stuff to go in it. Holding out for the high price of your dreams is not going to work and is setting us all up for a great big recession. So get real, people. This ain't fantasy land.
Austin Goolsbee is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. He's also an advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Take a minute to share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Toyota's rise to be the number one car maker on the planet could have to be pushed back a year. The latest global sales figures out today show General Motors might just have hung on to its lead the first 9 months of this year by a relatively razor-thin margin of about 100,000 cars. Troubles here in the North American market are forcing U.S. automakers to cut costs any way they can. They're trying to offload some of their retiree obligations, and they're extending that tough love outside the immediate corporate family. From WKSU, Amanda Rabinowitz has the story of one longtime GM supplier.
Al Myers strolls through his plant. He's got perfect posture and a crisp white shirt. The president of Allied Baltic Rubber knows most of his 190 workers and their spouses by name. He smiles and stops to chat while they make GM suspension parts.
How's Brenda doing?
Good.
Tell her I said hi.
Myers has been with Allied Baltic Rubber since 1960. His father was past president and his grandfather founded the company. GM accounts for 80% of his business. Myers says over the years, GM has pressured him to keep prices so low that his last price increase was in 1984.
The methods that they're using now border on cruelty to animals. They're so relentless and so overbearing with their requests for price reductions that they really don't care whether you go out of business or not.
A GM spokeswoman says the company goes to extreme lengths to keep suppliers profitable because when suppliers go out of business, she says it's disruptive and costly to find new ones. But in 2005, GM said it would slash purchasing costs by 30%. The carmaker blamed rising steel and plastic prices for $2.5 billion in losses. It asked suppliers to cut back on using those materials. Myers primarily uses rubber, but that's gone up too.
General Motors will not allow a price increase. And when you look at the price of cars, which go up annually, people think that you're getting an increase on your products annually, and it's unfortunately not the case. Wish it were.
GM's relationship with suppliers has gone from friendly to frosty, according to Melinda Barkis. She's been with Allied Baltic Rubber for 8 years. And in the car-making business for 3 decades. She says that changing relationship is an indicator of the future of car-making.
My dad always said when I was a kid growing up, don't make it your life because eventually Japan and all the rest of them are going to take over. And it's going that way. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Back in 2005, 85% of suppliers surveyed described their relationship with GM as poor. John Hankey heads a Detroit consultancy called Planning Perspectives. He says domestic suppliers have to swallow the losses if they want the business to stay here in the U.S. But Hankey says if suppliers can weather the next few years, the domestic industry could rebound.
Everybody is looking mostly at China and say, oh my gosh, you know, what can we do against China? Well, China right now is being faced with inflation. We've got issues with transportation and that. You know, you can't easily get parts from one part of the world to the other except by plane, and that's incredibly expensive. If those companies can stick it out for a while and improve themselves, they're going to become increasingly competitive.
Allied Baltic Rubber's future is uncertain, says Myers.
You try to maintain your own identity, but I believe for the smaller independent companies, it will be even more difficult in the years to come.
In other words, he might just do what lots of other independent suppliers have, sell out to larger companies to survive. In Kent, Ohio, I'm Amanda Rabinowitz for Marketplace.
Coming up, the dangerous world of audiobooks.
Harry, obedience is a virtue I need to teach you before you die.
But first, let's do the numbers. A strong tech sector boosted stocks today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials rose a third of 1%, 44 points, to close at 13,566. The NASDAQ rose more than 1%, 28 points, to close at 2753. The S&P 500 moved up a third of 1%, 5 points, ended the day there at 1506. Shares of Apple shot up more than 2.3% ahead of earnings today. After the bell, Apple announced a 67% rise in quarterly profits. ExxonMobil spilled 1.3% lower after oil futures fell more than a dollar a barrel to around $87.50 a pop. Merck was healthy today. Shares of the drug Singulair boosted its shares 2.75%. Markets overseas were generally lower following Friday. Back home, Britain's FTSE fell more than 1%. The French CAC 40 lost 1.3%. Germany's DAX was off 1.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. These days, it seems that everyone is talking about sustainability. Want to know how you fit in? A new online game from American Public Media can help you find out what the world might look like if everyone lived, or at least consumed, like you. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Consumer Consequences.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee holds a hearing on the anthrax scare of 6 years ago, focusing on our preparedness to respond to bioterrorism. A House committee discusses improving consumer protection and dealings with telemarketers and on the Internet. And weather permitting, NASA launches Space Shuttle Discovery, sending the crew on their way to the International Space Station. This mission will be manned by a woman. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. China watchers spent today trying to figure out who's who in the new Politburo that President Hu Jintao announced this morning. The once every 5 years Communist Party Congress wrapped up in Beijing over the weekend. In Washington, trade officials had other things on their minds. The U.S. has asked the World Trade Organization to investigate Chinese restrictions on American movies and other media. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong has our preview.
China sure looks enticing to Hollywood. Consider 1.3 billion people, a growing consumer class, and an affinity for Western films, like the 97 blockbuster Titanic.
Is there anyone alive out there? Can anyone hear me?
Titanic showed in more than 1,000 Chinese theaters and grossed $43 million. But beneath the surface, beware the regulatory icebergs. Chinese law lets U.S. studios keep just 13% of ticket sales. And every year, Beijing allows in just 40 foreign films. Washington calls these unfair trade barriers. And whether the WTO agrees or not, Jonathan Landreth of the Hollywood Reporter's Beijing Bureau says the fact is media is the most tightly controlled industry in China.
When the medium is the message and this is a one-party town, what gets on the big screen is still of interest to the very highest level of the Communist Party leadership.
Hollywood has flirted with Chinese filmgoers since the 1920s. Films by Charlie Chaplin and other Americans dominated the Chinese market. In fact, many Hollywood studios forged exclusive contracts with Shanghai theaters. But the Communists came to power in 1949, and China was off limits to Western films till the mid-1990s. The door has opened slowly since then, partly to give domestic filmmakers time to develop. Zhao Zizhong is with the Communication University of China.
I think it'll still take some time for China's film industry to build itself up. So for now, I think the foreign films quota should remain in place.
But even if Hollywood makes headway in China, will enough folks come through the turnstiles? Again, Jonathan Landreth of The Hollywood Reporter.
Going to the movies in China is still a white-collar date. Movie tickets in Beijing sometimes cost more than $10.
Compare that $10 to 70 cents. That's the cost of a bootleg DVD in China. We know because we've been shopping around. For research purposes, of course. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Agriculture policy is tough enough in any case, all those subsidies and crop quotas and all that stuff. But try this one for just a second. What if every 7 years farmers just stopped farming, took a nice long break, let their land lie fallow for a whole year? Just such an agricultural sabbatical began recently in Israel. From Jerusalem, Daniel Estrin reports the devil is in the details.
The instructions come straight from the Bible. Rabbi Rafi Feuerstein flips right to the verse, Leviticus 25. 6 years thou shalt sow thy field, and 6 years thou shalt prune thy vineyard and gather in the produce thereof. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest for the land.
And that's a fantastic vision, to rest and to live the normal secular life, vocational life, for more spirituality. Let the business life rest.
But people need to eat and farmers need to make money. So the main solution involves a sleight of hand. The Israeli farmer sells his land to a non-Jew with the understanding that he buys it back in 1 year. That way the Israeli farmer continues to work the land, except technically it isn't his anymore, and so he isn't violating the biblical law. Jews have been doing this for a century, but many ultra-Orthodox Jews, like this one who shops in Jerusalem's outdoor market, say this is a sham.
You sell it to a non-Jew, so it supposedly belongs to the non-Jew, but the land, is it really yours or not yours? There is deception in this.
Instead, the ultra-Orthodox have stocked about 3 months' worth of provisions, and they plan to import food from Jordan and the West Bank. That infuriates other religious Jews, including Rabbi Feuerstein.
Israel is a state in war. You cannot say today, you know, let's destroy the agriculture in Israel and let's bring everything from outside. What will happen if we are in war and the Jordanian won't give us the vegetables which are grown there? What then?
But people want their local greens, so farmers have come up with another solution, one that lets them keep their land and grow on it during the fallow seventh year. Agronomist Arik Orlov.
Okay, the deal is here. We plant it on perlite, as you see.
So how many plants total? It's 300?
Millions, I don't know. Millions.
On a kibbutz bordering the Gaza Strip, Orlov oversees rows and rows of dill, celery, spinach, and lettuce. But here's the thing, they're all in pots. The pots stand on plastic sheets, and the soil in the pots is artificial. Since nothing's growing in Israeli soil, the rabbis gave their stamp of approval.
Okay, so first of all, the land here doesn't work. You can see we have plastic.
And so all this plastic is to prevent one drop of water to get into the land?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rabbis approved the detached planting technology just a few months ago, Orlov says, and it's been a scramble to get the operation up and running.
It's the year of atrof. Craziness.
His land may be resting this year, but Arik Orlov is working as hard as ever. In Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Atlanta's traffic nightmare is apparently Random House's dream come true. The publisher has targeted Atlanta commuters for a new ad campaign. It urges them to while away their drive time with audiobooks. And it's working. Atlanta audiobook sales are up 11% over last year. Of course, when Atlantans listen to audiobooks, they can't listen to public radio shows. And so the Marketplace players bring you this public service announcement.
Audiobooks kill.
I thought I'd spend my commute listening to Harry Potter on CD. Then I got to chapter 34.
Harry, obedience is a virtue I need to teach you before you die. Perhaps another little dose of pain.
Voldemort's voice was in my car. I didn't want it in my car. I took my hands off the wheel to cover my ears. Why didn't I listen to Marketplace?
Every year, like 20,000 people or something are injured in audiobook-related catastrophes, and 100% of all audiobook listeners eventually die.
I survived the crash. The audiobook didn't, thank God.
Burn your audiobooks before they burn you.
Rico Galliano writes and performs for the Marketplace Players. He had help today from Michelle Philippi.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation, at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, we told you last week that Congress was able to get some key information out of some telecommunications companies, namely what kinds of private information the companies have been giving the government since September 11th. One thing that wasn't revealed, though, is how much the government ponies up for the info. Well, wonder no more. A blog called Secrecy News has dug up a document that outlines Comcast's rates for surveillance requests. $1,000 for the initial startup fee. The feds get the first month of eavesdropping included with that. After that, $750 a month. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 44 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq skipped up 28 points. That's more than 1% there. The S&P 500 hiked up 5 points, a third of 1% there as well. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, unraveling the puzzle of green power.
The most environmentally benign plant, power plant that I can build, is the one that I don't build.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.